Some of you, most of you may know that I drive a Lexus. It's because I'm very rich. What actually happened there was that about the time we were expecting James, we were living in Michigan, and we were driving this old Chevy. It's a Chevy Cavalier, and the brakes were giving out. When we moved here, we ended up selling it for scrap. And about that time, my grandmother went into nursing care for Alzheimer's, and my uncle just called up and suggested that we have my grandmother's car. It's kind of a strange experience to just one day have somebody call you on the phone and say, would you like a Lexus for free? It's not something, obviously, we would have ever asked for. And if we had been shopping for a car, it would not have been a Lexus. And yet, without asking for it, it was just given to us. Now, don't think for a moment that I'm going to stand here and preach to you a prosperity gospel, that if you're faithful to God, he'll give you fancy cars. That's not the message. But it's a metaphor. It's a reminder that God is more gracious than we often ask or even imagine. That God is, while he doesn't always give us the things that we ask for, in fact, he often gives us far more than we are willing to ask. That's not to say in terms of houses and cars and things like that. I've quoted C.S. Lewis this passage before out of his essay, The Weight of Glory. It's a great piece of work. But let me read this again. This is what C.S. Lewis says. He said, if we consider the staggering nature of the rewards promised in the gospel, it would seem that our Lord finds our desires not too strong but too weak. We're half-hearted creatures fooling around with drink and sensuality and ambition. When infinite joy is offered to us, like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because we cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea, we are far too easily pleased. And I think sometimes that the reason that we have a hard time imagining what God is offering us is because of the brokenness of the world that we live in. Because we've kind of accustomed ourselves to the pain of everyday life. And in fact, that brokenness, that pain, goes deeper than even we think. And the solution is not easy. The difficulty in receiving the great rewards that God intends to give us is a substantial difficulty. And the cost was even greater than we could imagine. And yet God is willing and able to overcome the difficulty in order to give us more than we dare to ask. So our passage today in 2 Kings chapter 4 brings us past the life of Elijah, squarely now into the ministry of Elisha. And I can't believe I haven't misspoken those names yet, as far as I can remember. Maybe you noticed it last week. But Elijah, the J-A-H, comes before the Elisha, S-H-A, so you can remember they're alphabetical. But Elisha's ministry is, in many ways, very different from that of his mentor, Elijah. You never see Elisha by himself. He's never alone the way that Elijah often was. He always has a helper, or he's with somebody. He receives a lot more support than Elijah ever did. And even though Israel is still in a time of decline, and no king of Israel after the split between Israel and Judah ever really calls people to repent and come back to the Lord, yet this current king, King Joram, is still not as bad as the abominable reign of King Ahab, his father before him. And so Elisha, as we see, is in a little bit of a better situation. He's traveling around Israel a bit. Why don't we throw that map up on the screen there? So he actually spends a lot of time up in Mount Carmel. You see the mountain up there, kind of on the northern edge of Israel on that Kishon River. I don't know why he spends a lot of time there. It never really says what he's doing there, except that that's where Elijah, his mentor, had that big showdown with the prophets of Baal where fire came down and everybody said, "The Lord, he is God, the Lord, he is God." So maybe it's a place for Elisha to kind of be with God and, you know, remember where he's come from. But then he does a lot of traveling down to Samaria. And Samaria is the capital city way down there, kind of in the middle, even towards the south end of Israel. He can't make the trip in one day, so he needs some place to stay in the middle. And very often, apparently, he gets in the habit of stopping at this town of Shunem, right there about halfway between Mount Carmel and Samaria. So that's where we'll pick up the story today. This is 2 Kings chapter 4, verse 8. One day, Elisha went to Shunem, and a well-to-do woman was there who urged him to stay for a meal. So whenever he came by, he stopped there to eat. She said to her husband, "I know that this man who often comes our way is a holy man of God. Let's make a small room on the roof and put in it a bed and a table, a chair and a lamp for him. Then he can stay there whenever he comes to us." One day, when Elisha came, he went up to his room and lay down there. He said to his servant Gehazi, "Call the Shunammite." So he called her, and she stood before him. Elisha said to him, "Tell her, you have gone to all this trouble for us. Now what can be done for you? Can we speak on your behalf to the king or to the commander of the army?" She replied, "I have a home among my own people." "What can be done for her?" Elisha asked. Gehazi said, "Well, she has no son, and her husband is old." Then Elisha said, "Call her." So he called her, and she stood in the doorway. "About this time next year," Elisha said, "you will hold a son in your arms." "No, my lord," she objected. "Don't mislead your servant, O man of God." But the woman became pregnant, and the next year, about that same time, she gave birth to a son, just as Elisha had told her. This kind woman in Shunem receives a greater reward than she asked for. The first thing that we learn about her is that she's relatively wealthy. All the way through the Bible, Old Testament and New, we get warnings about the hazards that wealth can lead you into. But then you also get examples like this that show you it doesn't have to be that way. So in the New Testament, this woman Lydia lives in the city of Philippi, and she's well off. And she decides to use that wealth that's been given to her to support Paul and the whole church in Philippi, which ends up meeting in her home. In the same way, this Shunammite woman, whose name we never learn, she's just called the Shunammite, she uses her wealth in ways that honor God. And so she was not asked to give anything to Elisha. She just decided to go out of her way to look for something to do for him. It says she urged him to stay and eat with them. And that one act of kindness became a long-standing pattern of generosity and hospitality. And then it went so far that she even said to her husband, "Hey, let's remodel our house to be dedicated to the work of God and to this man, Elisha." And she says that the motive she's going for is because he's a holy man of God. And so her generosity, her hospitality, is driven by her reverence for God. Now, we're working with just a few details here, so I don't want to try to draw too thorough a picture than what we actually have. But this Shunammite woman seems to be a good example of an ordinary person that uses the resources that God has given them for the things that God cares about. Now, you and I, on a global scale, are relatively wealthy. Compared with the poverty that most of the world lives in, we are rich. But instead of feeling guilty about that, instead of feeling like, "Oh no, I must have done something wrong to get this curse of wealth that the Bible is so uncertain about and so nervous about," We can gratefully use those resources and look for opportunities to use what we've been given for God's work, the things that he cares about, the care for the poor and the work of the gospel and the glory of his name. These Operation Christmas Child boxes are a great example of that. And the hats and mittens that we're giving away are a great example. And anything that we do that supports the youth group and their ministry. And the food pantry here in Moreland. These are all great examples, and God is pleased with those things. And I'm continually encouraged when I look at First Christian Church to see the generosity of so many people in this church. And let me just repeat what Paul says. I say this to your credit, that God is pleased with the gifts that you give. And I just want to say, well done, First Christian Church. This is something that I think is a real strength of our congregation. And I'm very pleased to say that God is pleased with the gifts that we give. But now Elisha says, well, what can I do to reward this woman for her kindness and her devotion? And she can't think of a thing. He says, well, could I ask a favor of the king for you? I mean, the king of the whole country, which all automatically shows that Elisha is clearly in a better position with the authorities than Elijah was before. Few less death threats than Elijah tended to receive. And she says, no, I'm good. I've got a house, a home among my own people. Who could ask for anything more, right? And then Gehazi, you know, Elisha's not satisfied with that. And so his servant Gehazi, for once, has something really insightful to say. He puts his finger on something that she was not willing to mention or didn't think of mentioning, and that's a child. And so without her even asking for it, Elisha just says, all right, even though you would not ask for it, you're going to have a child this time next year. And notice, she's not indifferent to the idea of having a child. I mean, when he offers this gift, he makes this promise to her, it's almost like he's hit her in the gut. She says, oh no, my Lord, don't mislead your servant. It's not that she doesn't want a child, it's that she wants it so badly that it hurts, and she can't stand to have somebody offer that and then be disappointed. God knows the desires of our hearts more deeply even than we do. One way or another, God, whether she didn't think to ask because she'd just given up on the hope of ever having that thing, or whether she had thought of it but then suppressed that idea in her mind because she couldn't stand, she didn't dare to ask it. One way or another, God brought it to light, and he promised what she would not dare to ask. Sometimes we serve God with kind of like this bargain in mind. You know, some people will do this. They'll say, okay, God, I'm going to do this thing for you, but you've got to give me what I want, okay? I promise I'll do this if you will give me what I want. This is kind of the nefarious thing about the prosperity gospel. It starts out with worldly desires that we want, and then it kind of uses God as a means to achieve the end that we're really striving for. And so sometimes we think, well, the godly alternative to that must be just not to expect anything from God at all. Don't ask for anything. Don't expect a reward. You just put your head down and soldier on. You know, don't expect anything. Just keep your mouth shut and do your duty. It turns out that God is greater than both of these things. That God doesn't always give us what we ask for, but in fact, he gives us more than we dare to ask. The prosperity gospel, as C.S. Lewis would say, is not wrong because it expects too much of God, but because it expects too little of God. When God wants to give us something infinitely greater than that, God knows what we desire. And oftentimes we try to fill in our desires with what's available to us. We have these deep longings inside of us that we kind of try to fill in with whatever we can get our hands on. You know, food and drink and relationships. When God actually has in store for us, for those who love Him, as 1 Corinthians 2 says, what no eye has seen, what no ear has heard, and no mind conceived. Not just the partial fulfillment, but that thing that we've never seen before, but deeply crave and try to fill with other things. And Psalm 37 says, delight yourself in the Lord, and He will give you the desire of your heart. Not the temporary thing that partially satisfies, but the ultimate thing, the deep thing that temporary thing is just a shadow of. God knows what we desire because He's the one that created us with those longings, that need for infinite love and for unlimited joy and for unshakable peace and for that fellowship with the God that created us, that sense of belonging, all those things, that eternal life that we long for, that we try to fill up with other things. Those are the things that He promises us, and it's greater than we can possibly imagine. So this child that Elisha promises to the Shunammite woman is just a reminder that God is able and is willing to give us more than we dare to ask or even think to imagine or to hope for. And I think that the reason, again, that we don't dare to hope, the reason we don't dare to ask is because we've become so accustomed to the pain and the loss of this life that we live in, this world with its disappointments. Verse 18, here's the hard part. The child grew, and one day he went out to his father, who was with the reapers. My head, he said to his father. His father told a servant, carry him to his mother. After the servant had lifted him up and carried him to his mother, the boy sat on her lap until noon, and then he died. She went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God, then shut the door and went out. She called her husband and said, please send me one of the servants and a donkey so I can go to the man of God quickly and return. Why go to him today? He asked. It's not the new moon or the Sabbath. It's all right, she said. She saddled the donkey and said to her servant, lead on. Don't slow down for me unless I tell you. So she set out and came to the man of God at Mount Carmel. When he saw her in the distance, the man of God said to his servant Gehazi, look, there's the Shunammite. Run to meet her and ask her, are you all right? Is your husband all right? Is your child all right? Everything is all right, she said. When she reached the man of God at the mountain, she took hold of his feet. Gehazi came over to push her away, but the man of God said, leave her alone. She's in bitter distress, but the Lord has hidden it from me and has not told me why. Did I ask you for a son, my Lord? She said. Didn't I tell you, don't raise my hopes? Elisha said to Gehazi, tuck your cloak into your belt, take my staff in your hand and run. If you meet anyone, do not greet him. If anyone greets you, do not answer. Lay my staff on the boy's face. But the child's mother said, as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you. So he got up and followed her. This now bereaved mother responds to her crisis with focused desperation. This child is maybe 5 years old. She'd hardly begun to enjoy the desire of her heart that had been given to her before it was suddenly taken away. And even though she maintains a remarkably composed exterior, on the inside she is in bitter distress. And yet instead of turning this way and that way, not sure what to do with herself, kind of in a frantic state, her desperation is a focused desperation. It's focused on one answer, and that is the man of God that promised her the child in the first place. We can already see immediately what she has in mind when she goes up and lays the boy on Elisha's bed. She knows what she's doing. And then she goes to her husband and she doesn't tell him what's going on, which is maybe not advisable. And yet she must be thinking, what can he do anyway? She tells her servant only enough to get her where she's going as fast as possible. And even when Elisha sends his servant to go ask what's going on, even that's not good enough. She's got one answer in mind, and she is focused on this, and nothing is going to deter her from it. Her attention is fixed on the one person that might be able to help because he's the one that promised it in the first place. And when she finally gets there, when she gets to Elisha on the mountain, she just grabs hold of his feet, and she doesn't even ask him for anything. Once again, she doesn't even ask, but she just pours out her heart to him in just kind of this bitter cry of, didn't I say, don't mislead me? And even when Elisha sends Gehazi to go as fast as he can and settle the situation, she's not satisfied with that. She says, interestingly enough, the same words that Elisha said to Elijah in last week's passage in chapter 2. As the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you. She demonstrates the same commitment to him, the same focused devotion that Elisha himself showed before. She will settle for nothing less than the one that gave the blessing in the first place. And all along the way, she says something very unusual to her husband, to Gehazi. What is it that she says that is so strange? She says, it's all right. This is a remarkable assessment. Her little child has just died. How is this all right? And maybe she... It's hard to say what's going on in her head right now. We like to conjecture. You know, maybe she is just putting on a fake exterior of composure. Maybe she's just acting like she's okay when she's not. If so, that's not what we want to learn from her. But let's imagine something better. Let's imagine there's something better going on in her mind right now. The word that she actually uses here, where it's translated, it's all right, is the Hebrew word shalom. And the Hebrew word shalom means peace or well-being. It is well. Now, when Elisha first promised this child to her, she didn't even have the faith to accept it, to believe that. She could not bring herself to believe in that promise. And yet, beyond all of her expectations, God did it. He gave more than she even imagined was possible. And so maybe her faith now is beginning to grow. Maybe she's reached a place after seeing that God is more gracious than she imagined he could be, where she's willing to put it in God's hands. Maybe when she says it's all right to her husband and to Gehazi, what she's saying is, this is not in your hands. And it's not in my hands either. There's only one person right now in the universe that can do something about this, and that's God. And because it's in his hands, it's all right. God gave me a child when I didn't even dare to ask for it. And now I don't know how. I don't know how this is going to turn out. And yet I believe that God can do something with this greater than I can possibly imagine. Now, I will not by any means suggest that we ought to hide our problems from other people, from friends, family, professionals. You know, I don't think God would at all condone the idea of shutting ourselves away from doctors when we're sick and demanding that God heal us apart from any human means. And yet we can learn something from this Shunammite woman's focused desperation. We can learn not to let anything, to let no other help, no other hope prevent us from pursuing with desperate longing the one person in the universe that can do something about it. You know, Jesus teaches us to pray not just once and then let the matter drop, but if you're reading our scripture passages this week in our reading plan, Luke chapter 11, he says, be like that friend at midnight that's just banging on your neighbor's door until you get him up out of bed to help you. Be committed to prayer. Pray like you have no other hope in the world except what God can do for you. I don't mean by any means to minimize our crises. Far from it. I think the brokenness of the world is greater even than we know, because we've never seen the world as it's supposed to be. And yet God is able to heal that brokenness, even though it takes more than we dare to think. Look at verse 31 with me. Gehazi went on ahead and laid the staff on the boy's face, but there was no sound or response. So Gehazi went back to meet Elisha and told him, the boy has not awakened. When Elisha reached the house, there was the boy lying dead on his couch. He went in, shut the door on the two of them, and prayed to the Lord. Then he got on the bed and lay upon the boy, mouth to mouth, eyes to eyes, hands to hands. As he stretched himself out upon him, the boy's body grew warm. Elisha turned away and walked back and forth in the room, and then got on the bed and stretched out upon him once more. The boy sneezed 7 times and opened his eyes. Elisha summoned Gehazi and said, call the Shunammite. And he did. When she came, he said, take your son. She came in, fell at his feet, and bowed to the ground. Then she took her son and went out. Elisha discovers that the depth of this need can only be met by a personal work of healing. The stick didn't work. Right? He sends Gehazi with his stick to lay on the boy's face. And we appreciate Elisha's urgency here. Right? It shows compassion for the woman and her child. That he immediately, as fast as possible, extends help. And yet, it doesn't work. And as Elisha himself admits to Gehazi in verse 27, God has not revealed to him everything that's going on here. You know, back in 27, he said to Gehazi, she's in bitter distress and the Lord has hidden it from me and has not told me why. Now that's kind of strange, isn't it? That God would hide something from his prophet. Why is that? Why does God hide this from Elisha? Let me suggest, now it doesn't spell it out for us, let me suggest that the reason God hides this from Elisha is the same reason that the stick didn't work. And that is that God wanted to teach Elisha just how personal this was going to have to get. He doesn't just reveal to Elisha what's happened to the child because he wants Elisha to hear it from the Shunammite's own trembling lips. Not just the information, but the anguish, the pain of it. And that's why the stick didn't work. He didn't just want Elisha to descend somebody else with a stick. Elisha actually had to be there, had to learn how to relate with this boy in his death, to touch him in his death, mouth to mouth, eyes to eyes, hands to hands. I mean, this kind of physical contact with a dead body would make him ceremonially unclean according to the law. And yet that's what it was going to take. This boy is dead. The solution is not going to be easy. This is something we need to pay attention to when we want to share God's love with people. If we want to help people, if we want to share God's love with them, we can't do it at a safe distance. We need to be personally involved with them. You know, these Operation Christmas child boxes, the reason they work is because we send them into the hands of churches and Christian workers that are there on the ground that can give them personally to these children and love them personally. I mean, Samaritan's purse knew what they were doing. We don't just send them off and just drop them in somebody's lap. That's a tool used in the hand of a loving Christian to get into the life of somebody that needs to hear the love of Jesus. Likewise, if we want to help our neighbors or our family or our friends understand the love of God, we've got to get our hands dirty in the stuff of their real lives. Because that's what Jesus did for us. Our situation is far worse than we're usually willing to recognize. We were spiritually dead, and there was nothing that could bring us to life aside from a personal work of healing. Even God, when he looked upon our need, our desperate situation, didn't just send a prophet to wave a stick over us. But he came down to our level and he identified with us in the most personal way imaginable. The only way for us to be brought to life was for Jesus to lie down with us in our death. Mouth to mouth, eyes to eyes, hands to hands. He participated in our death with us so that we could participate in his life with him. That is why we can trust him even in our most desperate crises. Because God didn't just brush off our needs. He didn't minimize the desperation of our situation. But in a way more powerful and more staggeringly gracious than we could have possibly asked or imagined, he came into our situation with us and healed us more deeply than we ever could have asked. And that's why we can look at every crisis that we face and trust that it's in his hands. Because he came into our death with us so that he could give us that eternal shalom, that eternal well-being. We can look at every crisis that we face in the meantime and still say, it is well. Because if God would go that far, if he would love us to that degree and heal us that deeply, then we can trust that he is in charge. He is holding all these things in our hands, and he is loving us more graciously than we could have imagined. If God is for us, then who can be against us? He who did not spare his own son, but gave him for us, how will he not also, along with him, graciously give us all things? I wanted to respond to this message with singing "It Is Well With My Soul." So just, you can remain seated for the moment. You can turn in your hymnals, number 705, or you can just